In what way is the knowledge of Jesus' heavenly ministry helpful to me here on earth? Welcome to The Good Word. Our theme for today is the efficacy of Jesus' priestly ministry. My conversation partners are, once again, Paul Dibdahl, Larry Baverka, colleagues in the Walla Walla University School of Theology. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go with that question. I'd like to maybe kind of personalize it. What does the knowledge of Jesus' heavenly ministry mean to us here on earth? Can you give me some insights as to what has been enriching in your experience?
I think I tend to be maybe more of a concrete thinker than some. Maybe it's just simplistic is all I'm really saying here. But when I think of Jesus and his heavenly ministry, it's just helpful for me to be able to picture in kind of concrete terms the fact that Jesus is still actively involved in the ministry of forgiving people. He's not just up there in the sky watching what's happening. He isn't removed from the process of salvation, but he continues to serve in that way. It kind of gives Jesus something to do, I guess, in my mind, which is, as I said, perhaps simplistic, but for me, helpful.
Yeah. Oh, I can't. I don't know how most people is, but I've heard other people say, and it's certainly the case for me, I can't think unless I can see in pictures. You take all the pictures away, I might as well go back to bed. See, I need to be able to see it. And the funny thing about it is I still see when record keeping up there. My suspicion is that the Lord has a fairly sophisticated computer system. But as far as my head's concerned, he uses quill pens. And I don't know where he gets the turkeys, but that's kind of the pictures that I grew up with.
If your brain and all of its cells, which stores every event of your life in technicolor sound and smell, is a turkey quill, then so be it. But when I think of the ministry of Jesus on my behalf, my mind first of all goes back to Gethsemane and the kind of experience that Jesus endured there. I think of some moments in my life that have been personal Gethsemanes. And my mind goes then to Hebrews 4, where we have this marvelous passage about a high priest. Of course, Hebrews stresses that Jesus is our high priest because he is human. He has lived our human experiences. And he has gone into heaven. He's Jesus, the Son of God. That's why we must hold on to what we have said about him. Jesus understands. The word is has a fellow feeling. It's koinonia. He understands our every weakness, because he was tempted in every way that we are, and without sin. So whenever, and this is the passage that just sort of rings to me, whenever we're in need, and whatever our circumstances, whatever experience we're going through, we can come, in the King James, boldly to the throne of grace. We can come bravely before the throne of our merciful God. There we will be treated with undeserved kindness, and we'll find help. Because he understands, because he's been there, because he's been in the most challenging and difficult circumstance of human existence, he understands my pain. He understands what I'm going through, and that can give me incredible confidence to approach him and to know and ask for all the resources of heaven to be poured out on my behalf and to know and believe that he'll do that. That's his ministry for me.
Would you say, Larry, that Hebrews 4 is kind of a central passage for you as you think in terms of, I mean, you've mentioned that one. That's the one you specifically mentioned, is it?
Well, yes. It contains a great deal of meaning, help for me, yeah, sure.
Do you have, Paul, do you have a particular passage that is helpful for you?
For me, it's more Jesus, the one who suffered, the one who knows what it is to be unjustly treated, even to the point of death, that Jesus is the one who is seated at the right hand of the Father, and as it says in Acts, forgiveness is proclaimed in his name. Mm. It's more the proclamation of forgiveness than necessarily the mechanism by which that is made possible. It's the declaration of that desire and willingness and power to forgive. That's the one for me that I grasps me moves me.
There's another image that's been very meaningful for me to correct. I mean, when we started out so many weeks ago, Alden, you made reference to the image of the argument going on between Jesus and the Father as to whether or not they ought to be scorched or saved, you know. And to realize that the accuser of the brethren, the one who is bringing the case against me, is Satan, not the Father, and that the argument goes on essentially by Jesus claiming the right to forgive me, based on what he has done and accomplished on the cross. He has won that right. And he essentially shoots Satan down over... I mean, Satan's got the laundry list that doesn't end on from my behavior and lifetime. But he says, I have the right to forgive, and blot that out. And he makes that case in full harmony with the Father.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that to get that picture straight in my head has meant a great deal.
Well, I've got a couple of passages that are very meaningful for me. John 16, verses 25 to 27, where you have the corrective of that scary statement in Ellen White that we must stand in the sight of a holy God without a mediator. In the light of John 16, you can turn that from a threat into a promise, where mm-hmm. Jesus actually says, mm-hmm. You will pray in my name, and I do not say that I will pray the Father for you, because the Father himself loves you. Ty Gibson has a marvelous sermon on that, where he just simply says, the only reason you need a mediator is because you have two parts that are separated. You know, when you come together, then you don't need the mediator anymore. But the passage that is really deeply rooted for me is Zechariah 3. And by the way, if any, especially those in the Adventist community, tussle with the question of the judgment, the pre-Advent judgment, standing in God's presence, I would highly recommend the commentary in Ellen White's book, Prophets and Kings, on Joshua and the angel. It's a marvelous one, and there's a bit of a story there. In the 1880s, Ellen White was really discouraged. She says, is there any way that God's people can be brought into the kingdom? We are so weak and so frail. And in vision, the angel actually came to her and pointed to her to Zechariah 3, the first time that there's any reference where she actually used it. And this ties in something you said, Larry. I remember Dr. Heppenstall used to say, Satan doesn't have to tell any lies about it. All he has to do is tell the truth. Mm-hmm. See? But it is Satan who's the accuser of the brethren, not God. And most of us are thinking, if you've got that reluctant God up there, he's looking at, ha-ha, gotcha, Thompson, out, can't do it. But I like to think, take that even further, where the Lord, with a bit of a twinkle in his eye, says, you think you've got a complete list, Satan? Yeah, I got a whole lot more than you do. I've got a complete list, see? But that's not the crucial issue. And this passage ended up being such a tremendous blessing to Ellen White, and I've kind of taken the shine to it as well.
This is a Zechariah 3
passage. Zechariah 3, yeah. Then he showed me the high priest, Joshua, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to accuse him. And the Lord said to Satan, the Lord rebuke you, O Satan. The Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is not this man a brand plucked from the fire? Now Joshua was dressed with filthy clothes as he stood before the angel. The angel said to those who were standing before him, take off his filthy clothes. And to him he said, see, I have taken your guilt away from you, and I will clothe you with festal apparel. And he said, I let them put a clean turban on his head. So they put a clean turban on his head and clothed him with the apparel, and the angel of the Lord was standing by. It's just a marvelous picture of what Jesus can do for us. So I think the idea of Jesus' heavenly ministry is terribly important for us. Now, there's a couple of other images that I'd like to play with here. We have a few minutes to explore this. When we think of Jesus, there's a very strong image, the Lamb. Well, let's say a very gentle image. There's the Lamb, and then there's Jesus as the Lion. Both are biblical. And then the book of Revelation has that remarkable phrase, the wrath of the Lamb.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you think in terms of what Jesus represents up there, I would be interested in how you mix those two metaphors, Jesus as Lamb and Jesus as Lion, or putting them together, the wrath of the Lamb. Any reflections on that might be helpful for our listeners?
Well, I'm not sure how to... I'm not sure I even understand exactly what you're meaning.
Well, the gentle side, you mm-hmm. know, the Lamb.
Mm-hmm.
And then the, you know, if we could borrow a C.S. Lewis phrase, yeah. Aslan is not a tame lion.
Right.
Yeah, he's
uh-huh.
powerful. You have this strength over here. But he's also pretty scary. So, you know, how do you sit on the lap of Jesus if he is a lion?
I think I've been blessed with authority figures in my life who, from my perspective, have been a wonderful kind of, I don't know if blend is the right word, of the Lion and the Lamb. They've been authority figures. They have had power. But yet there's been the tenderness, the soft side as well. So I don't know that I've grappled with this issue perhaps in the ways that maybe some other people have. I recognize that it's two sides, but I don't see it as necessarily, you know, mutually exclusive. Oh, no, how can I put these together?
Mm-hmm.
I go back to Gethsemane again for the picture of the wrath of God against sin. And I see it, Jesus experiences it from the Father. But what I see the wrath and the there is a father whose hands are tied while his son suffers, and he has the power to intervene, but must restrain himself in order to allow his son to experience the choice that he finally made in Gethsemane. That's mm-hmm. torture. That's mm-hmm. that's aggravating. It's terrible to have to experience that. That's the anger. I mean, and Ellen White talks about that three times. The anger, the wrath of God against sin is how he relates to what's happening to his son. I see Jesus feeling similarly about those who have chosen to be lost instead of among the saved.
Yeah. And, of course, even in real life, if you need to be carried by someone, you don't want to be carried by a 97-pound weakly.
Mm-hmm.
You want someone with power and strength, mm-hmm. with real muscles. That maybe is important. Thank you, Larry and Paul. Next week, our last topic this time around is return as king and friend. I want to thank both of you for helping out, and to Josiah Hackerott for helping us. For The Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.